Good morning, Goldnox. Welcome to Weather Aware, presented by The Morning Show, Laurier's one and only weather radio talk show. I'm your host, the one and only Liam McGuckin. I just want to say welcome back from Reading Week, folks. Hope everybody is well rested and rejuvenated. I know I am, but I'm also left missing Reading Week a lot. You know, I've written about 20 pages of writing or so far this week, and unfortunately, I don't even know if that's an exaggeration or not. Forget how busy late October gets at university, but I will take writing assignments and essays over formal midterms any day of the week, though, as I'd rather write over study, because if I had proper midterms for my other classes, I wouldn't be here this week getting to talk to you lovely people about the weather. If you got any more midterms coming up or any midterms outstanding, just think about the relief you'll feel when it's over with. That's my advice, honestly. As long as you do your best, that's all anyone can ask for. We got a pretty meaty show today, folks. We got 17 pages worth of notes. So let's just get right into it with the show forecast. In the first hour of the show, you can expect a very news-oriented segment. I got a triple feature of weather news for you in the news recently before I discuss a nasty Alaska storm that could have been handled much, much better. In the second hour of the show, one of my favorite segments returns as we talk about Supercell, a movie that definitely is not trying to rip off Twister. After that, I give you all a deep dive into storm chasing before ending off the show with your weekly forecast, my trademark guaranteed 3-day forecast, and your Laurier exclusive news report, which I will add, I don't remember late week news reports being so small. I guess it's because I had the Wednesday shows last semester, but I've been noticing there's a lot less news on the Instagram accounts, on campus, that kind of stuff. Everything happens on Wednesday for some reason. I don't know why, but that's just something I've been noticing. Moving into the recap, today's recap is special because I'll be coming at you with a double recap, one for Reading Week and one for this week. Before getting into the weather recap itself for Reading Week, I just want to quickly recap what I did over the Reading Week. Not much, you know, aside from going out to watch Tron with a few buddies and having a nice birthday dinner for a friend. I got the lovely privilege of being able to chill out with my family for a week in lovely Mississauga. Anyone out there with dogs at home must know how exciting it is to come home and see them just flip out when they see you. Since I came up to Waterloo on the Tuesday and came back again to Mississauga on the Wednesday, I got to see that twice. My puppy, Ivy, or at least she looks like a puppy, but Ivy was just so very happy to have me at home. My other dog, Bowie, was so happy that she tried to get me a housewarming gift to bring back to my apartment. A dead rabbit. I just cannot describe the horror that is seeing your 10-year-old Boston Terrier bring a dead rabbit that she killed all the way to the back door. But I didn't look at it close enough, thinking it was a toy. I don't know what I would have done if she came inside with it. Just had to get that out there because, you know, you gotta look at everything half glass full. And above all else, it made for a terrific radio story. And I just found it kind of funny that a 10-year-old dog could still do that. I honestly did not know a 10-year-old dog could still hunt. As for the Mississauga weather, I gotta tell you, Waterloonies, that we are missing out. Mississauga has warmer weather. And they had warm weather all of last week leading up into the weekend. You know, sometimes it was like spring last week. It was very, very nice. Got some nice sun outside. Me and my family went to the St. Jacob's Farmers Market on the Saturday. It was lovely. lovely weather last week, but the weekend happened, of course, and we did get some rain on Friday night in Mississauga, where, you know, we almost got rained out at the birthday dinner I went to. As I came back from Mississauga to Waterloo, I was reminded of Waterloo's weather as I was greeted by a rainy and cloudy Sunday, just like it is today. As I look out the window, all I see is a very gloomy, windy, and cloudy day, unfortunately. You know, on Sunday, I thought it was nice. After a week of sun, you know, I didn't mind the break from sun into more cloudy and rainy weather. But, you know, I did miss the Mississauga weather after a few days, because if you've been in Waterloo recently, you'd know that since Sunday brought a rain system with a cold front, it has been nothing but rainy and cloudy and cold and all that so fun stuff in Waterloo. You know, I actually recently went out with a buddy on Tuesday night to walk and talk. I had read earlier in the day that there is some kind of like flooding risk going on in the region. I didn't know that was for Tuesday, though. We got rained on hard, dude. It was pouring rain on Tuesday night. We had some fun walking in the rain when it calmed down, but when the rain picks up, it really tends to pick up. You could even see your breath at night. I noticed that. It got so cold from the rain that it started, your breath became visible, which, you know, it just still seems a little too early for that. That's just my humble opinion, but it still seems a little too early for being able to see your breath. Let's at least wait until November for that. Come on. There's no reason for October to see your breath. As for the forecast accuracy, looking back, you know, a week ago, my forecast was pretty solid. You know, again, nothing crazy happened with the weather, so it's not too difficult or anything to forecast temperatures, but it's still good to know the forecasts are accurate. I wasn't able to give a forecast for past Thursday of reading week, obviously, but it was just not a great end to reading week. It was nice during most of reading week, but moving into the weekend, it was not fun at all. That out of the way, we're going to go on a short break now. It is currently 10:08, 7 degrees with a sharp, sharp wind chill of 4. I know, 4 degrees in Waterloo with a wind chill and cloudy in Waterloo, Ontario. You know, overall, it's just been really rainy in Waterloo. Even this morning, it was raining. In the past few days, it's been raining in the morning. And if you've been in Waterloo lately, you probably felt the pain in the morning rain as it soaked you to the bone. Gonna play us into the break with Live Forever by Oasis on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. If you didn't know or were at or just weren't at the Oasis concert, it started pouring rain at that concert, and they played that song just as it started to intensify. It made for some killer visuals, man. A lot of people are saying that night one of the Canada concerts, or the North America concerts in general, was better than night two because of the rain. So that just goes to show how good weather can be sometimes. Anywho, if you haven't been keeping up with the news lately, there's been a lot of weather representation lately. Three places across the world faced weather-related events that were newsworthy, which isn't exactly great for them, but it is great to report on. So I'm coming at you with a triple feature today. We're going to start out with an isolated event in France and end off with a typhoon that hit the Philippines with a nice, brief Canadian story wedged between the two of them, because you just can't go wrong with Canada. Starting out with France, they just can't seem to get a break lately. If you haven't seen the news in general recently, and this was when I was researching for the show, I only learned this on Tuesday. The world-famous Louvre recently had a $102 million jewel heist. And it just seems that even Mother Nature won't cut them some slack as a rare yet severe tornado ravaged the Val d'Oise suburb. On Monday afternoon, a tornado of unusual intensity swept through Val d'Oise, a suburb just north of Paris. The storm's sudden and powerful appearance stunned local authorities and residents. Within moments, it brought down cranes, uprooted trees, and caused severe damage to property. Unfortunately, the most tragic outcome of the storm was the death of one person. It was a victim of the extreme weather confirmed by the Val d'Oise prefecture. The storm's intensity was unlike anything seen in the region in recent history, with officials calling it a rare event. As the tornado ravaged the area, the storm knocked out power to at least 1,700 people. Local utility companies were quick to respond, thankfully, working around the clock to restore electricity. The power outages added to the strain on the already overwhelmed emergency services, and some areas remained affected for several hours. The emergency efforts continued as local authorities worked tirelessly to assist residents. The focus shift to providing shelter, medical aid, and restoring basic services like electricity and water. The gym in Ermont is being used as an emergency shelter for those displaced by the tornado. With the help of volunteers and rescue teams, affected families are being accommodated and supplies are being distributed. Despite the devastation, the community has shown resilience, with many coming together to rebuild their lives. Interior Minister Lauren Nunez expressed his condolences and support for the residents, first responders, and elected officials who were dealing with the aftermath of the tornado. He confirmed that the storm had struck with a rare and sudden intensity, catching many by surprise. The region, known for its relatively mild weather patterns, was ill-prepared for such a destructive force because they've never had such a destructive force, or at least have not had one in a long time. Experts are currently analyzing the storm's unexpected power, which has prompted discussions on how to better predict and prepare for similar occurrences in the future. France is next poised to be hit by yet another storm soon, named Storm Benjamin. Definitely odd to see a tornado with such violence in October. You know, usually these kind of storms are much like the garden center at Loblaws or Zahar's or whatever version of a garden center, you know, out of season. What isn't out of season is wildfires. Did you know that the Canadian wildfire season lasts from April to October? Canada is getting very... Mother Nature, specifically in Canada, is getting good use out of that time frame. Gearing into a more local scale, people in the potential path of a wildfire near Ompa and North Frontenac were asked to leave their homes on Sunday evening, according to the township and the OPP. It was a windy day, which, you know, if the LA fires taught us anything, is a very, very bad thing with wildfires. What happened is around 6 p.m. on Sunday night, part of Highway 509 was closed due to this wildfire that had broken out between South Levant and Snow Roads. Very interesting road name, that last one. Snow Road. Two evacuation centers were set up at the Ompa Community Hall, and another community hall was also set up as an evacuation center. North Frontenac Mayor Jerry Lichty has gone on record saying that 15 to 20 people left their homes, and it's not yet known when they'll be able to return. Alicia Spencer, someone living near the wildfire area, had said that they were first alerted by the fire burning near them by a call from her stepson all the way in Kingston. This is because since the fire happened at night, a lot of people were caught off guard by it. Thankfully, though, the OPP has said Monday morning that there had been no reports of injuries or serious damage and no further evacuations were needed. Ontario saw some nice rain come in with that cold front, so it helped mitigate fire risks a lot. Since this event happened, the road reopened Tuesday evening, and the township said the evacuation recommendation was lifted late Tuesday afternoon. There have been no reports of injuries or damages to infrastructure, thankfully, and all is well. It's definitely not a huge story going on, you know, nothing crazy, but I found it worth mentioning as well. You know, it's also always good to fit in as many Canadian stories as possible. I also just find a wildfire in October pretty interesting. It's technically in wildfire season, but usually you see that kind of stuff happen more so in July, June, August, more late spring and summer kind of months, so it's definitely odd to see one happen all the way in October. So again, not a huge story, but what is a huge story, however, is Tropical Storm Fengshen, or Tropical Storm Ramil in the Philippines. The storm, which formed on October 12th, recently made landfall in the Philippines. Anticipated waves of 2 meters led the Philippines Weather Bureau, PEGASA, to issue a risk warning of moderate coastal flooding for the region. 27,000 people were evacuated.
1 second, folks.
My mouse just fell. My bad, folks. 27,000 people were evacuated from the Albay province because of these warnings and moved to a safer area further inland. As it made landfall within 24 hours, Fengshen generated 400.7 millimeters of rain in Jiwan, eastern Samar, and 365.5 millimeters in Roxa City, which was greater than the monthly average in those areas. The PCG in Bicol reported that 757 passengers were stranded in the region along with 108 rolling cargoes and 5 vessels on October 17th. The next day, 3,239 passengers were stranded nationally, while 12 seaports in Calabarzon were shut down. Floods were caused in Iloilo and Catanduans. 2 transmission lines in Quezon were unavailable. A 23-year-old woman drowned from slipping in a creek in Capiz. Another death was recorded in Roxa City when a 44-year-old man got swept away by floodwaters. The total number of deaths was 7. 2 from Western Visayas and 5 from Calabarzon. 2 individuals were declared missing, and around 375 classrooms were damaged, of which 118 were destroyed. 33 residents in flooded areas in Roxa City were rescued. A state of calamity was declared in the city. Water levels in Bansud, Oriental Mindoro, were inspected by local officials, while officials in Capiz did the same. The Department of Social Welfare and Development of Romblon prepared 25,000 food packs for affected communities. And it was also mentioned... Sorry, getting weird notifications. It was also mentioned and reported that, of all things, bats were reported to have somewhat predicted the storm earlier than warning systems, which is very interesting. So, from rare tornadoes, wildfires, and tropical storms, it's been a pretty hectic week in the weather lately. The craziest part of all is that none of these are nearly as crazy as another weather event that happened the last week or two. One that you can find out about after the break. That being said, we're going to go on another short break now. It is currently 10... Oh, sorry. 1 second, got to get my song prepared here. All right, we're good to go. It is currently 10:24, 2 degrees and cloudy in Waterloo, Ontario. After a major robbery at the Louvre, a rare tornado, and soon Storm Benjamin, I think France should try to just take it easy for a bit. The Eagles on Radio Laureate. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. A lot of stuff has been happening in the land down under us recently. America has seen its fair share of disasters, natural and not natural. Over the reading week, there was yet another disastrous typhoon, separate from the previous one that happened in the Philippines, that ironically could have been much better handled in Alaska if there were more precautions in place. Let's just put it that way. I have previously mentioned Trump's budget cuts to the NOAA and how they can be disastrous for storms, but we haven't really seen proof of this yet. It's always been theoretical. It could happen. What if it happens? Those kind of statements. But we've never been able to see if these budget cuts have had an impact. At least not until reading week. This Alaska storm is a story about a very rough typhoon, but also a story of what happens when you consider weather and public safety as a non-essential service. Before all that, though, as always, what is this typhoon? How did it form? Sounds like a brief meteorological synopsis is needed. On October 3rd, as we were prepping for midterms coming up, this is way, way long ago in early October, a broad area of convection of about 489 kilometers formed southeast of Iwo Jima, Japan. And by the way, a convection, I know it sounds like a complicated word, I know, but it's pretty simple. A convection is when warm air rises and cool air sinks. The air warms up, rises, and as it rises, it cools and then sinks. This is called a convection current. So, this area of convection was in a marginally favorable environment of typhoon growth, and thus, the following day, the Japan Meteorological Agency began monitoring this system, and it was classified as a tropical depression. The Joint Typhoon Warning Center later issued a tropical cyclone formation alert. With that in place, the depression would intensify into a tropical storm on October 5th, gaining the name Haluang. It would then intensify even more, and by October 11th, it was a Category 4 strength typhoon. It would move northward over the next day and was located just south of the Aleutian Islands. It would then move into the southern Bering Sea that afternoon, and then it moved north along the western coast of Alaska on October 12th. It made landfall near Buckland later that day, and this is where our story starts. In western Alaska, flood and high wind watches were issued ahead of the storm's expected intensification as an extratropical storm, which is this typhoon, by the way. It was expected. You were expected to see winds up to hurricane force. It was a very bad storm overall. Heavy winds, heavy rain, the whole nine yards. These were later upgraded to warnings, with comparisons made to ex-typhoon Merbok in 2022, which caused severe flooding in some coastal communities in September 2022. The remnants of Haluang brought significant impacts to Alaska, with the worst of the impact in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Wind speeds of 181 kilometers per hour were measured in the Kusilvak Mountains. The storm caused record flooding in Kipnuk and Kwik-Iling-Kok, where several people went missing after numerous houses were floated off their foundations. Just floated out into the ocean. Lovely. The Coast Guard rescued approximately 20 people from their homes after the buildings had floated out to sea. A roof detached from a home and a school boardwalk was damaged in Kongiguginganuk. These are very hard word names to pronounce, but I'm trying my best. I got all the pronunciations Googled. This is just what Google's telling me. Water levels in Kipnuk reached record heights of 2 meters above mean high water. Boardwalks and roads were submerged across the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, while debris blocked the runway at Bethel Airport and a barge at Bethel broke from its mooring and struck a bridge. Elsewhere in western Alaska, strong winds occurred, resulting in... Resulting in roof and siding damage, airborne debris, and extensive tree damage. Several power outages occurred, including the KSKO radio station in McGrath, which was knocked off the air. And trust me, as a radio show host, I can guarantee no one likes being knocked off the air. In response to impacts from the storm, parts of western Alaska were placed under a disaster declaration by Governor Mike Dunleavy. On October 13th, after the storm, Alaska state troopers confirmed there is one fatality, with two others missing. They confirmed that all were accounted for from Kupnuk. They also sent a search helicopter and said that this search helicopter from Fairbanks was sent to deliver generators and fuel, with additional search and rescue efforts conducted jointly by the U.S. Coast Guard, Alaska Army National Guard, and Alaska Air National Guard. In Alaska, the storm resulted in one woman dead, along with thousands displaced. Governor Mike Dunleavy wrote a letter to Donald Trump requesting that he declare a major disaster in the state to unlock federal resources. He noted that it could take upwards of 18 months before many could return to their homes, and how, due to the time, space, distance, geography, and weather in the affected areas, it is likely that many survivors will be unable to return to their communities this winter. Senator Lisa Murkowski would go on record to say that this storm could take years to recover from. Speaking at the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention, she shared her experience visiting Kupnuk, a village where officials estimate 90% of structures were destroyed amid flooding and other extreme conditions, describing the widespread devastation and long road ahead for rebuilding. 90% of the village got wiped away. That is how bad the storm was. Her and two other members of Alaska's congressional delegation, U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan and House Representative Nick, sent a letter urging Trump to approve Dunleavy's request. They wrote that the scale of this disaster surpasses the state's ability and capacity to respond without federal support. With winter fast approaching and transportation and broadband connectivity limited, there is an urgent need for federal aid to repair housing, restore utilities, and secure heating fuel before severe winter conditions set in. How have they responded? Well, I don't know yet. I can't tell you. They are still waiting on a response from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which this was at least as of writing this on Tuesday. So I guess we're just going to have to wait and see how FEMA responds. As for some history with Trump's organization, there's a good bit of context worth bringing up. You know, see, the village of 700, Kupnuk, had been rewarded a $20 million grant by the Biden administration to combat problems connected with permafrost thaw and other climate change effects. But in May, the Trump administration canceled that and other grants. This grant, a $20 million U.S. Environmental Protection Agency grant, was intended to prevent coastal erosion and protect against flooding. This was a lot of money to help protect this village, a lot of money. And this was to protect it from flooding. And from what happened over Reading Week, it's clear this grant was needed. So, as expected, criticism arose. This resulted in Lee Zeldin, the administrator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and that is the agency that gave Kipnuk this grant. This resulted in him going on Twitter, where he would defend the choice of taking away that grant. This is what he had to say on Twitter, and this is a direct quote. He said, and quote, "Dishonest left-wing hackery strikes again, as the New York Times well knows, but is just not willing to be honest in admitting the canceled environmental justice funding would not have prevented or safeguarded this community from the mass destruction and tragedy caused by such a large and devastating typhoon. And, to be brutally candid, due to the proactive cancellation of this grant, $20 million of hard-working U.S. tax dollars are currently sitting in the U.S. Treasury instead of swept away into the Kuskokwim River. While politicians on the left would apparently prefer to have seen those precious tax dollars washed away, EPA now has the resources available to ensure the money is spent appropriately and wisely, including over $140 million this administration has provided to the Denali Commission and the state of Alaska. EPA also remains in active coordination with Alaska to support emergency response efforts. As for the clowns who want the EPA to light tens of billions of dollars, tax dollars on fire, we refuse to bend the knee and play along." I think my favorite part of his statement is the part where he says he's glad the money is in the treasury instead of swept into the Kuskokwim River. I don't think he could have put out a worse statement, honestly. That is just widely, widely insensitive to say he is glad the money is sitting in the treasury instead of swept away in the river. Why would he say that? What made him... freely say this on Twitter? Like, no one was forcing him to say this. I don't know. This might just be me, but this seems weird to say after a flood that wiped away 90% of a village. It just seems odd. I don't know. It seems very insensitive. As for those aforementioned budget cuts to Alaska and to NOAA, they were imperative to forecasting such a large storm. And this is where it's proven that the NOAA needs this crucial, crucial funding. There is currently a critical gaping hole in weather balloon coverage in Alaska, which is directly from the NOAA cuts back in February. Weather balloons, which are typically launched twice a day, provide crucial information on wind speed and direction, air temperature, humidity, and other measurements. Balloon data is fed directly into the sophisticated computer models used to predict the weather. However, there were few, if any, balloons to take measurements of what the weather was doing as the remains of Typhoon Hathuong approached Alaska late last week. This is important because the data could have helped the models more accurately predict the storm's path and intensity, as initial model projections had the forecast suggesting the worst conditions would strike farther to the south and west, more west than they did. Models like the Global Forecast System, which is operated by the National Weather Service, GFS for short, it's what I like to use for my storm watches whenever I end up doing them. Probably closer to November, if I'm being honest. But still, GFS, these models consistently showed a stronger storm to the northwest of where it eventually struck. The communities that ended up seeing the worst storm surge flooding weren't even in the original forecasts. Storm warnings were issued, but they were done without the aid of accurate model predictions. Rather, it was more so an on-the-spot weather warning done specifically by the meteorologists in offices. They had to base it strictly off of what they saw on radars instead of being able to put out advisories and accurate forecasts in general. The storm was described as the nightmare scenario for forecasters, with a depleted National Weather Service leading to fewer weather balloon launches in the run-up to a major storm. It was called a major model fail, though it's hard to know how much of that was due to the lack of balloon observations. You see, weather models lean on that weather balloon data in order to accurately predict incoming weather. If there are no weather balloons, there are simply either no models or just highly unreliable models, and this is what was seen with this storm in Alaska. The saddest part of this whole thing, of all these budget cuts, is that Alaska isn't alone in seeing balloon data gaps, with some NWS offices, National Weather Service offices, in the lower 48 states struggling to launch them twice a day as well. The National Weather Service is currently in the process of hiring meteorologists, technicians, and other specialists after the deep Department of Government Efficiency. You will never find me calling it that by its acronym, by the way. By the deep cuts led to service outages. You know, it's just baffling to me, absolutely baffling, how the Trump Organization continues to defend its poor choices with the NOAA budget cuts, as well as the cancellation of the grant. They claim that it's to save money and stuff, and it even seems that Lee Zeldin thinks this is the case, and he thinks that it's just nice and safe sitting in the Treasury. The issue I have with this statement, most honestly, is playing it up like the tax dollars down there are going towards this worthy cause, or that it's just not being wasted, it's safe and sound in the Treasury, because that's quite the opposite from what's happening. While Alaska reels from a devastating storm, one that could have been better handled through the money that Trump's administration took away, in my opinion at least, if you haven't seen the news lately, Trump has been busy. Trump is demolishing the east wing of the White House to build a $300 million ballroom. It was originally $250 as of 8 o'clock this morning, but it was a very, very recent announcement I saw on Newswire on Twitter, it's an official news account, that it's now being raised to $300 million as this huge, big budget ballroom that he is able to demolish an entire wing of the White House for. I didn't even know a president could demolish parts of the White House. Anywho, that's $300 million towards a cosmetic ballroom. That is where the $20 million grant and some of the funding cuts to the NOAA went. That is money, very important money, I will add, that could have been used to issue more weather balloons, accurately forecast the storm, or even just protect this town, Kipnuk, from flooding, or just better protect it, at least. Could have been used for much better uses, but hey, who knows? Maybe the ballroom will be gold. I know Trump loves his gold. Who knows? With that being said, I'm going to go on a short break now. It's currently 7 degrees, cloudy. And 2 degrees, hold on, let me restart this. My bad, folks. Gonna go on a short break now. It's currently 10:46, 7 degrees, and cloudy in Waterloo, Ontario. Gonna play us into the break with Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. If you didn't catch Season 1 last year, most of the episodes are up on Radio Laurier, by the way, and some exciting news, I'll add quickly, is now officially called Weather Aware with Liam on the Radio Laurier site. It's not the morning show on the little schedule. It says the Weather Aware now. I was going to mention that earlier. Completely forgot. Yeah, I noticed that this morning. It's really cool. Love that. But yeah, anyway, I had a lot of cool ideas and cool segment ideas last time. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. One of my favorites was relating weather to movies.
As an unofficial film minor student, I'm really, really passionate about film, so I love being able to talk about weather and movies. And I was also really disappointed after season one ended because I thought I talked about all of the weather movies. I covered the iconic ones, Twister, Twisters, all the Doomsday, all the big Doomsday ones, you know, The Day After Tomorrow, Geostorm, 2012. Covered also The Perfect Storm and The Impossible, both of which are easily the two best weather movies I've seen. Definitely can recommend checking those ones out. If you're bored this weekend or just bored in general, you want to watch a good movie, The Perfect Storm or The Impossible. Watch those ones. Fantastic. But ever since then, ever since I've started season two, I've had an itch, a great yearning to talk about weather movies lately. So I looked into it, and there are a good amount of weather movies left to discuss, thankfully. The one that caught my eye most is a movie called Supercell. It caught my eye because I'm not really that big of a fan of the whole, you know, doomsday, end of the world, disaster scenario seems in movies like The Day After Tomorrow or 2012. Supercell was not that breed of weather movie, but it was rather the other breed of weather movie. Thunderstorm and tornado centric. I generally think that there are two breeds of weather movies. You will never, ever really find a third breed. Is usually either tornadoes or huge out of scale, out of proportion, end of the world disasters with star power, a very weak plot. It's just popcorn flicks pretty much. But Supercell also caught my eye because of how similar it seemed to the movie Twister, which is arguably and iconically the weather movie. As much as I may think The Perfect Storm and The Impossible are better than Twister, Twister's following right behind those movies, by the way. Also fantastic movie, not knocking it by any means. Great, great movie. Twister was really one of the first of its kind to really popularize and promote that whole idea of, oh, we can make blockbusters off of movies. They had star power, they had everything going for it. It was a great movie. I at first thought that Supercell was a direct ripoff of Twisters because of the release date. I remember Twisters coming out in 2023, and this movie also comes out in 2023. I kind of thought this was a situation of either complete ripoff or riding off the hype of the tornadoes and storm chasing. But upon a simple Google search, it turned out that Supercell came out 1 year before Twisters, which is the legacy sequel to Twister. I know they sound very similar, but the sequel has a little S at the end. It's Twisters, not Twister. This doesn't stop it from being a little more than inspired by Twister, though. We'll answer that question at the end of this segment. But before diving into Supercell, it's worth re-explaining how these movie segments work because, it has been a while. It's been over 6 months. I think the last time I talked about a weather movie was April, and it is almost November. So definitely worth re-explaining, and worth explaining for any new listeners tuning in. It's pretty much a standard movie review. I go over plot, characters, cinematography, all the works, but I put an emphasis on a few things. Weather movies, in my opinion, are a separate breed of sci-fi, and thus they have their own set of conventions. These are movies that should take science somewhat into consideration, not entirely, but when the movie deals with science, I think that it should add up. This being said, though, I'm usually not very picky at all. Any means about the science, since my favorite franchise recently had flying mutant velociraptors and a huge Rancor T-Rex xenomorph monster mutant thing, whatever you want to call it, the Distortus Rex or whatever it's called. What I do care about is logic within the plot, visual effects, and action. Does the weather look good? Is it utilized well? That is what matters to me with weather movies. You don't go to a Godzilla movie and you're not going to criticize it for the fact that you'd never see a lizard grow to the size of the CN Tower because of nuclear radiation. You go to see it because it's a giant lizard that shoots atomic breath. And you're going there hoping Godzilla looks good and that Godzilla has some cool actions. Same thing for weather. You don't do a weather movie and not utilize the weather well. That's supposed to be the focal point of the movie. So expect to find a movie review with an emphasis on VFX, action, and any extra notes or critiques I have. I usually end these segments by comparing the science in the movie to real life if I feel like that's necessary. You know, not that it means anything. Again, my favorite franchises are science fiction, especially Jurassic Park, which is plagued with discourse on whether or not dinosaurs should be scientifically accurate or not. I don't care about the science. If it really, really doesn't add up when they're trying to be scientific, obviously that's different. But when I'm analyzing the science, it's more so just for fun. It's not going to raise or lower the rating really by any means, unless it's extremely well used with science or extremely bad with science. So with that basic housekeeping out of the way, it's time to ask the question. Is Supercell a ripoff of Twister? And is it worth watching? Let's find out. Starting out with the plot, Supercell definitely fits within that second breed of weather movie, but it doesn't necessarily do its own thing a lot of the time. The movie follows William Brody, so-called weather enthusiast. You'll see later on why I call him a so-called weather enthusiast. Studying meteorology and son of storm-chasing legend Bill Brody. After a catastrophic storm chasing his accident, William runs away to find his Uncle Roy, played by Skeet Ulrich, who truly understands why his father did storm chasing. William's mom, Quinn, also helped out with his father before quitting storm chasing to become a mother. William discovers a device that his parents thought of and made that can help locate and warn of an approaching tornado way before the normal warning systems can predict it. Sounds pretty familiar, if you ask me, and if anyone has seen Twister before, you probably have also heard of this somewhere. Not going to get into that yet, but I do have a list of these similarities, references, whatever you want to call them. All in all, I think the best way to sum up this movie is that it's a movie about a son discovering the mystery behind why his father did storm chasing, and then essentially living out to that shadow left behind as he learns what it takes to be a storm chaser, while also trying to help humanity, help the world with his little device that can help enhance and increase the warning time between when a tornado warning is issued and when a tornado actually happens. In my opinion, the film's plot feels more like a storm chaser-centric version of Twister, which I like, honestly. I like how heavy it focuses on the storm chasing aspect of these things. I think the plot works, honestly, and it's a pretty unique angle by purely focusing on storm chasing, really, rather than the usual mix of sciencey mumbo jumbo and storm chasing. You know, don't get me wrong, Supercell definitely still has that science mumbo jumbo all these normal weather movies have, like Cape values, GFS models, all that crap. But it focuses a lot more on storm chasing, which I think is cool. It's nothing crazy, and the film definitely drops it at times and has a really hard time juggling between the whole storm-chasing plotline and the whole gotta-save-the-world-with-this-device-dad-made plotline. But when it focuses on the storm-chasing, I really enjoy it. Moving on from plot, I overall enjoyed some of the characters, but overall also didn't enjoy others. It's very hit or miss. I probably like Uncle Roy the best. You get a really good sense of how confused and devastated he is by losing his storm-chasing partner, Bill. He is probably one of the better written characters. He has he has a good sense of humor in the movie as well. They don't try to phone it in all the time. A lot of the characters, they can kind of phone it in. But I think Roy, they don't really phone it in all the time, which I appreciated. He is played by Skeet Ulrich, which most notably, you would probably know him from Scream as Billy, which is Sydney's boyfriend. I will say that they all had some pretty notable actors in the movie. Aside from Skeet Ulrich, Alec Baldwin, of all people, showed up in this small weather movie. He plays Zane, which is the man who bought out the Brody Storm Labs company to turn it into a storm tour guide for tornadoes, going from a storm chasing business to a tourism business, essentially. He is by far the comic relief character, absolutely. But, you know, I enjoy it. I think he was funny at times. Alec Baldwin, I enjoy him in the most part. I think most people know who he is, but if you're like me, maybe you did not know that Alec Baldwin plays Adam Maitland in Beetlejuice, the husband of the ghost couple. Had no clue about that. I was searching up, you know, what notable roles has Alec Baldwin had that I might be able to say on air, and I learned that he plays one of the main characters in Beetlejuice. I had no clue. His voice is a lot higher pitch in Beetlejuice, I guess because he's a lot younger back then, which makes sense. I will say the character Zane that he plays has a very, very cringy, and because of how cringy it is, hilarious death scene. He gets sucked away in tornado, and because it has bad CGI of him getting flung around in the tornado, but he randomly just starts screaming at the tornado before getting abruptly swept away. That was hilarious to me. Moving to some of the more, not bad per se, but definitely on the worst side of acting, I think the mom, Quinn, the son, William, and William's girlfriend, Harper, definitely weren't the strongest points of the movie. There was one part where the mom randomly just started screaming the son's name into a car microphone, which I guess she thought loud meant good acting. Like, I don't know. Who's to say? It wasn't great. It wasn't great acting. You know, overall, as for the characters, I just feel like they needed some more screen time and development, especially the girlfriend, dude. She really, really needed something more to her. You see, she was essentially just kind of an accessory to William. Her entire character is just being the girlfriend. Which I think, considering she was also studying meteorology, or she was in the same school as him, and they both seemed to like weather a good bit, I think they could have, you know, built up on that more. Maybe build more on that weather relationship, that weather appreciation they both had, instead of just making her this one-faced character of just being the girlfriend. So, you know, overall, the acting is kind of hit or miss. Sometimes, you know, there's really good moments. Sometimes there's pretty bad moments. But usually it lingers around, you know, the it's okay range. It's not bad. It's not great. But it's okay. Very, very hit or miss acting. The movie doesn't really have a lot of cool cinematography. You know, I did notice one thing that the film tended to always keep the focal point of the shot sometimes in the center instead of the usual rule of thirds, which, you know, it is notable when they do that. Noticeable when you do that. But I say sometimes because of what I believe is the film's biggest issue. It feels like it's made by two people who never, ever met each other. And I know it sounds like a very weird criticism to say, so I'll explain it in a non-film way before getting back into the movie. Collector lines of action figures, you know, they tend to always have really, really good figures, like the recent Marvel Legends Venom they put out, and also have really bad figures, like a recent Spider-Man Hasbro put out. It's simply because two design teams are there, and one is much better than the other. This is how Supercell feels. Supercell will have these parts that are directed really well, very specifically lit, and there's a time of day established, characters act well. It's overall, you can appreciate it. It's like, oh, this is actually not that bad. It's actually kind of good. And then it suddenly shifts. The lighting turns yellow, time of day is destroyed, and it just feels off compared to the previous scenes. You know, it makes the whole movie feel weird, and it gets hard to keep up at points, you know? It's just, it's tricky when they keep switching from well-directed parts to not well-directed parts. It's just, I don't appreciate that. I feel like a movie should have unity, and I feel like this movie doesn't have unity all the time. But that can be excused if the VFX and weather are all good. You know, that's what's most important to me. So, how is it in the movie? This is just my opinion. You know, I definitely recommend that you go out, make your own conclusions if you want to. I'll get into it if I recommend the movie later, obviously. But I think the most disappointing thing about this movie is that they don't really utilize weather much. I think the best example I can think of is the opening, and I'll compare it with Twister. So not only can you get a good example and good idea on how similar the two movies are, but you can also get a pretty good idea on what these weather movies, this breed specifically of tornado storm chasing movies, should be like. Supercell opens with William's dad going on a storm chase. He's chasing this super really powerful tornado. But instead of showing the tornado, instead of showing the storm chase, they instead focus on the house where William and his mom are. And you just see them begging his dad to, you know, go north, get away from the storm. It then does a time skip afterwards, and you never, ever see what happened to Bill and his crew. Twister, on the other hand, gets you right into the meat and potatoes of weather. A tornado comes and ravages the town where the family of the main character takes shelter, and the dad gets swept away, leaving the family behind, and then a time skip occurs. Lots of similarities, I know, but arguably the one difference that Supercell has with between the Twister opening and its opening is that it doesn't show it what happened, but rather implies what happened. After some research, I think I can leave this up to budget. It did really only have a $1.5 million budget. That's at least what Google says. But I still think it would have been nice to see more weather in the movie, you know? But I will say, the little weather the movie does use, it is pretty cool. I'll say that. I'll give it that. It uses practical rain effects, which, if anyone knows me, they know I love practical effects in weather. So I obviously appreciate seeing practical rain effects take place. And it also strategically hides the tornadoes in complete darkness, where you can usually kind of make out what happens, what's happening with the tornado, but you can't really ever fully see it on display. This is simply just how the movie gets away with the budget. It has some impressive displays of tornadoes, but they hide them because they can't really afford to have these full-fledged segments unless when it's really, really needed, which I guess in a way I appreciate. I appreciate because when they do use weather, it is really well done, but I just think it would have been nice to see more of that spread out. It just felt to me like it was really just saved for the latter half, the second act, and most of the third act. I just think it would have been nice to see that spread out between each of the acts. I think the best part about this movie, though, is tying a bit into the science of it. You know, it's really about how much of a love letter this film is to storm chasers. The film uses real storm footage from storm chasers. Specifically, one that I can note and I noticed is Pico's Hank, which is a storm chaser I watch on YouTube. It was a really cool surprise seeing his footage make it on the movie. He has a really fun video called Making Supercell the Movie, where he goes in-depth with the director about his process. The science of the film, you know, it adds up very well, considering real meteorologists and storm chasers were involved, but it's the logic I don't really understand at points. For example, William is someone that is supposed to be studying meteorology with a family background specialty in tornadoes. At a point in the movie, they get caught in a thunderstorm with hail, and quickly after that, William asks, "Was that a tornado?" I don't know. Is it a tornado, Mr. I'm the son of a celebrated meteorologist slash storm chaser and someone studying meteorology? You of all people should know if it's a tornado a lot or not. That line bugged me a lot, man. I think that's on the same level as when in Jurassic World Dominion, Owen Grady, a park worker who fought an Allosaurus maybe 15 minutes before he said this, asked if a Giganotosaurus was an Allosaurus. I don't know, man. One's green and one's blue. And one also doesn't have Godzilla spikes on its back. You tell me. I don't know, Mr. Park Worker. You tell me. But anywho, that aside, it does have some logic issues. But I think it was really nice of the movie to get involved with storm chasers and meteorologists and even use their storm footage. And this also leads into my next point. The movie very much celebrates weather, and you can tell the people involved are extremely passionate about this stuff. Whether it's the real-life history or film history, this film has a lot to offer with weather history. Here's what I noticed. The movie immediately starts out by mentioning how the tornado that would kill Bill and his crew was like, quote, if Jarrow and Joplin had a baby, which are two devastating and destructive but very real tornadoes that happened, one of which I covered in a previous episode of Weather Aware. The mom, Quinn, also urges the dad to get away, telling him that, you know, we aren't going to pull another Joplin. We are not pulling another Joplin. I like this little callback or Easter egg. You know, it implies that how active that these storm chasers are, and then implies that they went to storm chase the Joplin tornado. Which, by the way, if you want to learn more about Joplin with survivor tales, there's a little documentary on Netflix called The Twister Caught in the Storm. It's a really good documentary. I can absolutely recommend that guy. The film is aware, and I appreciate how aware it is on how similar it is to Twister, and it almost purposely seems to reference it at times. As for similarities, I mean, where to start? Both the dads get killed by a tornado, then switches to a time skip. They both have this life-saving device to help increase tornado warning times. They both start and end with an awful tornado. I even noticed that they both use a barn as a main lab of sorts. The film references Twister a lot, though, so I guess you could call those less of copying ideas and more of it as like a nod to Twister. I still kind of think they're more than inspirations, but who's to say? There is a really fun reference to Twister, though, when the son searches up his dad's name, Bill. The name Bill Paxton comes up, and if you didn't know, Bill Paxton played Bill Harding in Twister. Oh, that's a fun little nod. The movie also has a small nod to The Wizard of Oz. The mother asks Harper, which is William's girlfriend, by the way, have you ever been to Kansas, Dorothy? You know, Harper has twin ponytails. So it's a definitely a reference to The Wizard of Oz, but by relation, it could also be a Twister reference, as the machine in Twister is named after Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. So it could be a double-edged sword there. Probably the biggest reference to Twister was the movie almost shot for shot recreating the Twister poster. There's a scene that shows storm chaser footage of a tornado forming with a dark, shadowy cloud, and it was overall just dark, very black colors with a deep yellow background. And if you haven't seen the Twister poster before, that is what the Twister poster looks like. It even had a very similar angle to which the tornado formed. It might not have been intended, but I immediately noticed this and thought of the Twister poster. The last Easter egg that I want to discuss is why I think they didn't show Bill's death. Considering what the kind of movie that this is, you don't do a Storm Chaser movie set 10 years after 2013 without referencing El Reno, and I suspect they did. You see, Bill's team was made up of three people, and they chased this tornado in a small white car. The movie only ever shows the hand of the father, as well as the crumpled and shriveled up remains of the white car they drove. I'm going to go into depth about it in the next segment, but El Reno featured the first weather-directed death of a storm chaser, more specifically, three of them, the Twistex team. It was also made up of three people, and they also drove around in a white car. The death is famous because while footage exists of what happened, it was never shown to the public what happened, but rather it was implied to the public. It was described as to what happened, and it was just left up to people's imagination to think about what happened to the Twistex team. People only ever found the car. I think the movie was trying to do a small nod. Or if it wasn't intentional, it's very, very big coincidences happening here, because these are extremely similar deaths and extremely similar scenarios surrounding these deaths. So with all of this out of the way, I think it's finally time to answer the question I asked at the beginning. Is Supercell a Twister ripoff? And is it worth watching? I definitely don't think it is completely a Twister ripoff, but it definitely takes a little more than inspiration from it. I think it's more of a celebration of storm chasing and weather in general, and I think that's nice to see such a passionate group of weather enthusiasts banding together to create a small movie. As for recommending it, I think if you appreciate tornadoes a lot, but more so if you're a fan of weather, if that makes any sense, it's definitely worth checking out. But I would also probably say to just go watch Twister and Twisters instead. You know, as much as I appreciate the fun nods and how enthusiastic the team behind this movie is, at the end of the day, either or of Twister and Twisters are better movies and use the weather better. They also have bigger budgets, so you're going to see a lot better looking storms in general. But Supercell is definitely not bad by any means. I think if you're bored and you've already seen both those movies and you're looking for a new tornado movie, go check out Supercell. Before going on break, I just want to say to feel free to recommend any and all weather movies that you know, good or bad. I love talking about weather movies, and I say the more the merrier. With that out of the way, we're going to go on a short break now. It is currently 11:21, 7 degrees with a small wind chill of 5, and cloudy with some wind in Waterloo, Ontario. This movie doesn't have its soundtrack on Spotify, and I would have played a song from its soundtrack. But if there is one song I can think of to sum the movie up, it'd be this one. Oh, My bad, folks. I didn't unmute the microphone. My bad, guys. Anyway, a little difficulty aside, if there's any song to sum up this movie, I would easily say it'd be this one. Because the one thing this movie makes sure to do is show you just what happens when you ride into the danger zone. I'm going to play us into the break with Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins on Radio Laurier. Welcome back from the break, and welcome back to Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show. Weather is a very broad term when talking about involvement. You know, there's lots of ways to be involved with the weather scene. The biggest one is obviously being a meteorologist, the sciencey kind, sitting in front of a computer doing all the legwork. Or you could also be a broadcast meteorologist like myself, and I'm an unofficial one, I guess, but that is where you get to have some more fun with the weather. That's what I like to do. I like being a broadcast meteorologist, unofficially. Get to have some fun with the weather, at least on my show. It's fun. There is a third major way that I can think of that gets you really involved with the weather. Really involved. And that is storm chasing. I figured after discussing such a storm chasing heavy movie, it'd be the perfect time to go in depth about storm chasing. Funnily enough, at least I find it funny, storm chasing has a definition. Storm chasing is, quote, the deliberate pursuit of any severe weather phenomenon, regardless of motive, but most commonly for curiosity, adventure, scientific investigation, or for news or media coverage. It's a very objective definition. I think there's a lot more subjective ways to describe it, but it definitely gets the point across. Storm chasing does not necessarily have a goal, per se, but from the ones that I follow and watch on YouTube, there's one thing that they all want to see. That would be a tornado. Go to any larger storm chaser on the internet, and most of the content they post is tornadoes, including Pico's Hank, the one I watch. I personally believe this is the case for a few reasons. For some, I believe it's a more simple approach. I think tornadoes are most common because it's the easiest to physically track. You know, its radar signature of a hook shape is iconic. And most that are even slightly into weather know about the shape of a tornado on radar. But obviously, there's an even more obvious answer, and that is that a tornado is just this huge funnel on the ground. It's very easy to see, and it's nice to track. But for a lot of others, I feel like it has more to do with the thrill of the chase rather than it being easy to track. A tornado is just about the scariest experience in weather out there, at least in my opinion. Depending on location and wind speeds and all these other elements, a tornado could come around and destroy everything around you with the risk of picking you up and flinging you hundreds of meters away. Being in a car is especially risky because all it has to do is easily pick up your car. And trust me, it is very easy for a tornado to pick up a car. And you're just kind of cooked from there. Unfortunately, if it picks you up in a car, you're kind of cooked. I think it's that thrill of chasing something that can just as easily chase you down. And if it shifts direction, suddenly there's a brand new thrill of going as fast as possible to get away from an impending storm and a possible impending doom. It also works together with a simple yet strong interest and fascination for tornadoes. I think the second is more common than the first because these people are not usually paid to do this, except for professional media crew chasers. Interestingly enough, some chasers organize their own ways to monetize the passion. An increasing number of chasers sell storm videos and pictures and manage to make a profit. A few operate chase tour services, as seen in Supercell, making storm chasing a recently developed form of niche tourism. This being said, though, they don't usually make a living off of it alone, and a lot of them tend to have other jobs. Chasers are also very limited by the duration of the season in which severe storms are most likely to develop, which is usually spring and sometimes summer, which is why the tornado that happened in France was very rare. It happened in October, which is very out of season. Storm chasing is also not a meteorology-specific thing. You know, while a lot of them happen to be meteorologists, there's absolutely zero certifications or degrees needed for storm chasing. Some National Weather Service offices do hold some storm spotter classes for those interested in America, and they are usually held in the early spring before storm season amps up. I'm going to go into some interesting history with storm chasing, as from what I gathered from research, it actually has a surprising amount of it, for what storm chasing is at least. The first person to gain public recognition as a storm chaser was David Hoadley, who began chasing North Dakota storms in 1956, systematically using data from area weather offices and airports. He is widely considered the pioneer storm chaser and was the founder and first editor of Storm Track magazine. Neil B. Ward subsequently brought research chasing to the forefront in the 50s and 60s, enlisting the help of the Oklahoma Highway Patrol to study storms. His work pioneered modern storm spotting and made institutional chasing a reality. The first coordinated storm chasing activity sponsored by institutions was undertaken as part of the Alberta Hail Studies Project beginning in 1969. Vehicles were outfitted with various meteorological instrumentation and hail-catching apparatuses and were directed into suspected hail regions of thunderstorms by a controller at a radar site. The controller communicated with the vehicles by radio. The hobby would later gain a lot of public traction with three things. In 1978, you had the broadcast of an episode of the television program In Search Of, in 1985 with a documentary on the PBS series Nova, and in May 1996 with the theatrical release of Twister, a movie that doesn't really glorify the hobby, but doesn't not glorify it. Watch it to reach your own conclusions. It's very fun. Personally, I believe Twister was what really made it popular. You know, it was a huge blockbuster with impressive effects, but also exposed general audiences to the idea that, hey, I could chase a storm if I wanted to. It's since become a huge norm and has been integrated into the weather community heavily. So, it sounds cool, but what does a storm chase usually involve? Well, usually chasers drive a lengthy way to reach their destinations, especially considering America is the only location you're really going to find a good chase. Not saying Ontario is bad or anything. If anything, it's a good thing, honestly, what I'm about to say. We just don't really get tornadoes often, and when we do, it's nothing too crazy. The point is that in America, there's one centric place you are guaranteed to find nasty tornadoes. Tornado Alley, a region in the central states, most notably being Oklahoma. So, these storm chasers will monitor radars and official weather agency activity, and when something pops up, even a risk for development, these guys drive to the aforementioned risk and then wait and wait and wait. Storm chasing's hardest part is simply the waiting game. It can last for hours, or even if there's an inactive pattern, days. This downtime consists of sitting under sunbaked skies for hours, playing pickup sports, evaluating data, or visiting landmarks while awaiting convective initiation. But when a storm does happen, it's a very in-the-moment thing, you know, very much go-go-go type moment, as there's little time to do anything except drive and catch the storm in the act. Navigating obstacles such as rivers and areas with inadequate road networks is a paramount concern. Only a handful of chasers decide to chase in Dixie Alley, which is an area of the southern U.S. states in which trees and roads heavily obscure the storms and often large tornadoes. The combination of driving and waiting has been likened to extreme sinning. A bust occurs when storms do not happen, sometimes referred to as a severe clear, but when storms fire but are missed, when storms fire but are meager, or when storms fire after dusk. You don't need a special car or anything, you know, despite what the movies tell you. I know Twister and Twisters and even Supercell have these really complicated looking and science fiction looking cars with all this satellite data outside of it, but you really don't need a special car. My favorite chaser team used a Chevrolet Cobalt, of all things. But it is handy to have radar technology available to track these thunderstorms and tornadoes. Nothing fancy, though. You know, when I need active radars, I use my radar or radar scope whenever I need a weather radar, which is an app on my phone. But you do need to see where the storms are on a radar in order to chase them, obviously. It is extremely, extremely important to note that this is a dangerous activity, especially with tornadoes coming at you. Gonna come at you now with some direct storm chasing lingo. Core punching, which is slang for driving through a heavy precipitation core to intercept the area of interest within a storm, is recognized as very hazardous due to reduced visibility and because many tornadoes are rain-wrapped. The bear's cage, which is something you will hear in Supercell, refers to the area where under a rotating wall cloud and any attendant tornadoes, which is the bear, and to the blinding precipitation, and which can include window-shattering hail, surrounding some or all sides of the tornado, which is the cage. Chasing at night also heightens risk due to darkness. So, in summary, you don't want to get caught in the bear's cage, because if you're caught in the bear's cage, you're going to kind of get screwed, because you can't see. There's a possibility your window's going to get broken from hail. It's a very dangerous area of heavy rain and hail. There have been many incidents with storm chasing, mostly due to driving, but the most tragic that I know of, as I briefly mentioned, is the Twistex team, who worked for National Geographic and the Discovery Channel on a dedicated storm chaser series. On May 31st, 2013, the El Reno tornado occurred, which is the widest tornado on record, but it is also known for being responsible for the first known chaser deaths inflicted directly by weather when it struck El Reno, Oklahoma. Engineer Tim Samaras, his photographer's son, Paul, and meteorologist Carl Young were killed on a rural road by the tornado while doing a probe and infrasonic field research. This death rocked the weather community, and it caused a lot of debates about storm chasing safety as we know it. And look, I'm not trying to scare you. You know, if anything, I think some of you wanted to hear about the incidents. Let's be honest. I'm just trying to be honest with you. It's a very dangerous hobby. One thing I like about the Twister films is that they don't entirely glorify it. They make it crystal clear that it is a very dangerous thing. And when it gets dangerous, it gets dangerous. I do have some advice about storm chasing safety for you guys, though. You know, I can't stop you if you want to go storm chase. I get it. I personally wouldn't storm chase. But I will keep any possible storm chasers listening in as weather aware as possible. It sounds obvious, I know, but it is very important for you to be aware in general. Keep your eyes posted on those radars to be aware of where the weather is. It's very important to also be aware of your surroundings, and I don't mean debris. Stop signs, cars, roadblocks, anything that could result in a car crash, you need to be aware of. Most storm chaser deaths aren't actually from the storm, but from the lack of driving safety. So as long as you stay safe on the road, you can stay safe from the storm. As for weather-specific tips, here's one I learned a while back from a storm chaser called Pico's Hank, the one that I watch. If you're chasing a tornado and it isn't moving, that's because it is moving towards you. If a tornado stops moving, start driving a different direction immediately, but preferably away from the tornado. Because again, once it stops moving, it's actually moving towards you. The best way to put storm chasing safety is this. Stay weather aware, stay road aware, and know the basics about tornadoes so you can get ahead of the storm. We're going to skip over the break as we only have 20 minutes left. I know it's very tragic, but I'll be back next week. And more on next week's show later. You might want to tune in for that one. So we're going to move into the forecast and conclusion of today's show. Starting out with the weekly forecast, nothing is 100% with the future forecast as always, hence why I'm only giving a basic overview. Especially for the latter of these days, it is subject to and is likely going to change. Overall, you're looking to look at the same, a lot of the same stuff we saw this week, you know, colder and wetter weather. For what it is worth, though, the sun will be coming out to say hi here and there. Sunday, October 26th, you're looking at a high of 11, a low of minus 1, and partly cloudy. Monday, October 27th, you're looking at a high of 10, low of 1, and partly cloudy. Tuesday, October 28th, it's going to be a high of 11, low of 3, and partly cloudy. And Wednesday, October 29th, is pretty much Tuesday's reheated nachos. It's the exact same thing, but with a slight, very slight risk of rain. You're looking at another high of 11, another low of 3, and a chance of rain, but otherwise cloudy. And Thursday, October 30th, you're looking at a high of 11, low of 2, and a chance of rain, but otherwise cloudy. And as a little bonus for you, Halloween. Ooh. Spoiler alert, the forecast might be a little scary. It's a high of 11, low of 4, but there's a risk of rain. Ooh. I know you might get rained out. We might get rained out on Halloween. More on that next week. I will note, I have seen some radar imagery and some models for next weekend. I think this rain's going to verify, unfortunately. But again, things could change. This is more than a week out. This is more so to give you a very, very general idea. Definitely tune in next week to hear the actual Halloween forecast. Moving to the Liam's locked-in forecast for the weekend. Today you're looking at a high of 9, a low of 3, and cloudy. This morning it was cold, it was cloudy, and depressing. There was some sun here and there, but overall, the same stuff we've been seeing for the past couple of days, which is a telltale sign that we are officially in the weird transition period of weather, where it doesn't know what it wants to be. I think we're definitely in the colder phase of this weird transition period, but still, you're looking at extreme temperature differences. It was 6 degrees, but felt like 4. In about 15 minutes or so, at 12 p.m., I guess more so 17, it is 43, but yeah, at 12 p.m., it won't be warming up too much, but a warm-up is a warm-up, and I will take that. It'll be 8 degrees. It feels like 5. Currently, it is saying that there is some light rain going on in Waterloo. I cannot verify this from my window, but I will say that looking at radar imagery, it does appear we are in a clump of rain, unfortunately. But I guess it's a little bit warm by like 1 degree with the wind chill, but still, I'll take that. I'll take it. By 5 p.m., you know, it'll stay like that for the rest of the afternoon as we move into the evening. You're looking at about 8 degrees. Feels like 5, and you're continuing to see that risk of rain coming in, but otherwise, it'll be cloudy. And by 10 p.m., you're looking at a slight chance of rain still, but I doubt it matters or not, since most of you won't be outside anyway, because it'll be 5 degrees and feels like 3. Good Lord, that is cold. Tomorrow morning, or tomorrow in general, you're looking at a high of 8, a low of 1, a slight risk of rain, but otherwise partly cloudy. Tomorrow, it just isn't looking any better. You know, if anything, it's colder. Anyone with 8:30 classes like me tomorrow can expect a 4-degree walk to class with a wind chill of 1 and cloudy weather. I just can't wait for that. By 12 p.m., it'll warm up a good bit, as it'll be 7 degrees, feels like 4, and cloudy, so not that big of a warm-up, but it's better than 1 degree, right, guys, with the wind chill? Yet again, the weather will stay the same for the afternoon, as it'll be 7 degrees, feels like 4, and cloudy by 5 p.m., and by 10 p.m., you're looking at Thursday's reheated nachos, as it'll be the exact same thing, but a tad bit colder. 3 degrees, feels like 2, and mostly cloudy. Saturday, looking at a high of 10, a low of minus 1, and mostly cloudy. Yeah, so unfortunately, you're not going to find any relief from this cold on Saturday either, unless you have a heater. By 8 a.m., it'll be 2 degrees, no wind chill at least, so I'll take that, and cloudy. By 12 p.m., it'll warm up, but that wind chill quickly comes creeping up on you, as it'll be 8 degrees, but feel like 6, and mostly cloudy by 12 p.m. Things heat up a little more in what is probably the hottest temperature you'll find in the next 3 days, as by 5 p.m. on Saturday, it'll be 9 degrees, feels like 8, and cloudy. And by 10 p.m., it'll be another cold and cloudy night. 4 degrees, no wind chill, and partly cloudy. So, all in all, I think it might be a good weekend to do something inside, somewhere warmer. Whether that's hanging out at someone's place, doing assignments, drawing, gaming, whatever you do. If you are going to go out, though, make sure you bring a coat out with you. You'll need it. A good thing you could do, if you celebrate, is start making a Halloween costume, as it is next week after all. Moving into a quick overview for my Mississauga listeners, my lovely Mississauga listeners. I can say somewhat similar things, but instead, let's focus on the positives. It'll be warmer and sunnier in Mississauga. Yay. Highs of low teens, like 12, 13 degrees, and lows of low to mid single digits, like 6, 7, 8 degrees. All that can be expected. I'd say maybe don't go out at night. You know, it'll be pretty cold, but the daytime should make for a nice drive. The weekend especially is looking nice for you. Saturday has a high of 12 and low of 4. Sorry, my mouse dropped again. Keeps dropping today. All right, we're good. Sorry. Yeah, so weekend's looking especially nice for you folks down in Mississauga. Saturday has a high of 12 and a low of 4 and partly cloudy, whereas Sunday has a high of 11, a low of 5, and it'll also be partly cloudy. So all in all, pretty good day. Moving into the Laurier exclusive news segment, Lance Eckensweiler will be at Wilf's tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. Lance is a local, and apparently he's a local favorite. So definitely go with a few buddies to listen to some live music, enjoy some good food, and just have a good night. Next up, are you good at table tennis? Do you know someone good at table tennis? If so, I want you to listen up. Hawk Walk is organizing a singles table tennis tournament. It's on October 28th, 2025 at the 24-Hour Lounge. Lots of twos there, I know. Lots of 20s, especially, at the second floor of the Fred Nicholas Campus Center. Come by and you can get a chance to win a gift card. Starts at 9 p.m. You can register at the link in bio of Campus Life Waterloo on Instagram. Again, that is Campus Life Waterloo on Instagram. Walk-ins are accepted, but only if space is available. Moving into sports news, tomorrow night, which is Friday night, the men's hockey team versus Guelph at the Waterloo Memorial Recreation Complex in Waterloo. That is at 7 p.m. Saturday, October 25th, you can find the women's hockey team bursting off against Queens yet again at this at the Waterloo Memorial Recreation Complex at 7 p.m. And lastly, Sunday, October 26th, you can find the MLAX team, which is the men's lacrosse team, by the way. Didn't know we had a men's lacrosse team, but if you're into lacrosse, go check it out. Men's lacrosse versus Toronto at the Ansley Alumni Field, which I believe is the giant football field we have. It's not University Stadium, which is right across the field from, what's it called? Waterloo College Hall. Sorry, I was blanking on the name here. It's not University Stadium, but rather it is at the Ansley Alumni Field, which again, I believe is the giant football field near the giant King Street residence. I don't think I have to clarify more than that. It's just the giant football field we have on campus. So yeah, that's going to be at 3:30 p.m. on Sunday, October 26th. You can get your tickets for all those and more at laurier.universitytickets.com. I repeat, that is at laurier.universitytickets.com. And for some non-Laurier sports news, as I'm sure everybody heard, the Blue Jays actually won. They made it to the World Series to face the Dodgers. Go Jays, go! This might be Toronto's year. I was honestly very shocked that they broke the Game 7 curse for Toronto sports teams. Usually Game 7 with these really important sports games, they usually end up fumbling. I can only think of Game 7 of the Leafs playoffs last year where they lost horribly to the point where Mitch Marner got traded. Awful stuff. So I was really, really happy to see that the Blue Jays were able to break that Game 7 curse. First game is tomorrow night at 8 p.m. and they face the Dodgers. It's a perfect thing to get together a few buddies for, maybe grab some drinks, grab some food, go to a sports bar, whatever you want to do, and go watch the playoffs. Go watch the World Series, not even the playoffs, the World Series. And one last little bit of business before I end the show. I just want to put it out there that my show next week falls on October 30th. Last time I had done a Halloween, not Halloween show, but last year I wasn't able to do really anything for Halloween except for a small recap segment because my show landed on the day after Halloween, November 1st. But this year is on October 30th, the day before Halloween. Just putting that out there. It's the day before Halloween. I'm just saying, you might want to tune in for next week's episode of Radio Laurier. If you know anyone that hasn't tuned in, definitely, if they want to, of course. I'm just saying, make sure to catch next week's show. Maybe I have Halloween stuff planned. Maybe I don't, you know. Who's to say? Who's to say, honestly? There's only one way to find out for sure, and that way is tuning in next week. And with that, that was episode 4. Sorry, lights just went out. That was episode 4 of season 2 of Weather Aware with Liam, presented by The Morning Show, Laurier's one and only weather radio talk show. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to catch next week's show for your weekly forecast and more. Don't forget to follow the official WeatherAware Instagram page at WeatherAwareLiam. Hope you have a great day, Golden Hawks, and remember, stay weather aware. Without things are looking with the forecast, I think it might be time to pretend like it's still late September, or at least a time when we still saw the sun. MGMT on Radio Laurier.